David watched with fascination. Was he finally seeing things, or was this for real? Abner was mixing a drink and watching, too. Eddie was mumbling to himself. "Good morning, Miss Spence," Abner said politely, almost with a bow. "Good morning, Abner," she said as she slowly lifted herself up and delicately mounted the stool. Her driver followed her movements with both hands but didn't touch her. Once she was properly seated, she said, "I'll have the usual." The driver nodded at Abner, then backed away and quietly left the bar. Miss Spence was wearing a full-length mink coat, thick pearls around her tiny neck, and layers of thick rouge and mascara that did little to hide the fact that she was at least 90 years old. David admired her immediately. His own grandmother was 92 and strapped to a bed in a nursing home, absent from this world, and here was this grand old dame boozing it up before lunch. She ignored him. Abner finished mixing her drink, a baffling combination of ingredients. "One Pearl Harbor," he said as he presented it to her. She slowly lifted it to her mouth, took a small sip with her eyes closed, swirled the booze around her mouth, then offered Abner the slightest of heavily wrinkled grins. He seemed to breathe again. David, not quite plastered, but well on his way, leaned over and said, "Come here often?" Abner gulped and showed both palms to David. "Miss Spence is a regular, and she prefers to drink in silence," he said, panicky. Miss Spence was taking another sip, again with her eyes closed. "She wants to drink in silence in a bar?" David asked in disbelief. "Yes," Abner snapped. "Well, I guess she picked the right bar," David said, flopping an arm around and taking in the emptiness of the pub. "This place is deserted. Do you ever have a crowd around here?" "Quiet," Abner urged. His face said, "Just be cool for a while." But David kept on. "I mean, you've had just two customers all morning, me and old Eddie down there, and we all know that he doesn't pay his tab." At the moment, Eddie was lifting his coffee cup in the general direction of his face, but was having trouble finding his mouth. Evidently, he did not hear David's comment. "Knock it off," Abner growled, "or I'll ask you to leave." "Sorry," David said, and went silent. He had no desire to leave because he had no idea where to go. The third sip did the trick and loosened things up a little. Miss Spence opened her eyes and looked around. Slowly, and with an ancient voice, she said, "Yes, I come here often, Monday through Saturday. And you?" "My first visit," David said. "But I doubt it's my last. After today, I'll probably have more time to drink and more reasons for doing so. Cheers." He leaned across with his pint of lager and ever so carefully touched her glass. "Cheers," she said. "And why are you here, young man?" "It's a long story and getting longer. Why are you here?" "Oh, I don't know. Habit, I guess, 6 days a week for how long, Abner?"
"At least 20 years.
She apparently did not want to hear David's long story. She took another sip and looked as though she wanted to nod off. David was suddenly sleepy, too.
Chapter 5. Helen Zink arrived at the Trust Tower a few minutes after noon. Driving downtown, she had tried to call and text her husband for the umpteenth time, with no recent success. At 9:33, he had sent her a text message instructing her not to worry, and at 10:42, he'd sent his second and final text, in which he had said, "No sweat, S-W-A-E-T, I'm okay, don't worry, W-O-R-Y. Helen parked in a garage, hurried down the street, and entered the atrium of the building. Minutes later, she stepped off the elevator on the 93rd floor. A receptionist led her to a small conference room where she waited alone. Though it was lunchtime, the Rogan-Rothberg culture frowned on anyone leaving the building to eat. Good food and fresh air were almost taboo. Occasionally, one of the big partners would take a client out for a splashy marathon, an expensive lunch that the client would ultimately pay for through the time-honored tricks of file padding and fee gouging. But as a general rule, though unwritten, the associates and lesser partners grabbed a quick sandwich from a machine. On a typical day, David had both breakfast and lunch at his desk, and it was not unusual to have dinner there as well. He once bragged to Helen he had billed 3 different clients an hour each as he shoved down a smoked tuna with chips and a diet soda. She hoped he was only joking. Though she wasn't sure of the exact number, he had put on at least 30 pounds since their wedding day. He ran marathons back then, and the extra weight was not a problem yet, but the steady diet of bad food along with a near-complete absence of exercise worried both of them. At Rogan Rothberg, the hour between 12 o'clock and 1 o'clock was no different from any other hour of the day or night. It was Helen's second visit to the office in 5 years. Spouses were not excluded, but they were not invited either. There was no reason for her to be there, and given the avalanche of horror stories he brought home, she had no desire to see the place or spend time with the people. Twice a year, she and David dragged themselves to some dreadful Rogan Rothberg social gathering, some miserable outing designed to foster camaraderie among the battered lawyers and their neglected spouses. Invariably, these turned into sloppy drinking parties with behavior that was embarrassing and impossible to forget. Take a bunch of exhausted lawyers, ply them with booze, and things get ugly. A year earlier, on a party boat a mile out on Lake Michigan, Roy Barton had tried to grope her. If he hadn't been so drunk, he may have succeeded, and that would have caused serious problems. For a week, she and David argued about what to do. David wanted to confront him, then complain to the firm's standards committee. Helen said no, it would only harm David's career. There were no witnesses, and the truth was that Barton probably didn't remember what he'd done. With time, they stopped talking about the incident. After 5 years, she had heard so many Roy Barton stories that David refused to mention his boss's name at home. Suddenly, there he was. Roy walked into the small conference room with a snarl on his face and demanded, "Helen, what's going on here?" "Funny, I have the same question," she shot back. Mr. Barton, as he preferred to be called, ran over people by barking first and trying to embarrass. She would have none of it. "Where is he?" he barked. "You tell me, Roy," she said. Lana, the secretary, and Al and Lurch appeared together as if they'd been subpoenaed by the same marshal. Quick introductions were made as Roy closed the door. Helen had spoken to Lana many times on the phone, but had never met her. Roy looked at Al and Lurch and said, "You two, tell us exactly what happened." They tag-teamed through their version of David Zink's last elevator ride, and without the slightest bit of embellishment presented a fairly clear picture of a troubled man who'd simply snapped. He was sweating, breathing hard, pale, and he actually dived headfirst back into the elevator, landing on its floor, and just as the door closed, they heard him laughing. "He was fine when he left home this morning," Helen assured them, as if to emphasize the point that the crack-up was the firm's fault and not hers. "You!" Roy barked in the direction of Lana. "You've talked to him." Lana had her notes. She had spoken to him twice, then he stopped answering the phone. "In the second conversation," she said, "I got the clear impression that he was drinking. His tongue was a bit thick, his syllables were not as sharp." Roy glared at Helen as if she were to blame. "Where would he go?" Roy demanded. "Oh, the usual place, Roy," Helen said, "the same place he always goes when he cracks up at 7:30 in the morning and gets plastered." There was a heavy pause in the room. Evidently, Helen Zink felt free to sass Mr. Barton, but the others certainly did not. In a lower tone, Mr. Barton asked her, "Is he drinking too much?" "He doesn't have time to drink, Roy. He comes home at 10 or 11, sometimes has a glass of wine, then he's out on the sofa." "Is he seeing a shrink?" "For what? Working 100 hours a week? I thought that was the norm around here. I think all of you people need to see a shrink." Another pause. Roy was getting his ass handed to him, and this was very unusual. Al and Lurch stared at the table and worked hard to conceal grins. Lana was a deer in headlights, ready to be fired on the spot. "So you have no information that might help us here," Roy said.
"No, and evidently you have no information to help me either, right, Roy?"
Roy had had enough. His eyes narrowed, his jaws clenched, his face turned red. He looked at Helen and said,
"He'll show up, okay? Sooner or later. He'll get in a cab and find his way home. He'll crawl back to you, and then he'll crawl back to us. He gets one more chance, you understand? I want him in my office tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock sharp, sober and sorry."
Helen's eyes were suddenly wet. She touched both cheeks and in a cracking voice said,
"I just want to find him. I want to know he's safe. Can you help me?"
"Start looking," Roy said. "There are 1,000 bars in downtown Chicago. You'll find him sooner or later."
And with that, Roy Barton made a dramatic exit from the room, slamming the door behind him. As soon as he was gone, Al stepped forward, touched Helen on the shoulder, and said softly,
Look, Roy's an asshole, but he's right about one thing. David's in a bar getting drunk. He'll eventually get in a cab and go home.
Lurch stepped closer too and said, Helen, this has happened before around here.
In fact, it's not that unusual. He'll be fine tomorrow. And the firm has a counselor on the payroll, a real pro who deals with casualties, Al added.
A casualty? Helen asked. Is that what my husband is at this point?
Lurch shrugged and said, Yes, but he'll be okay.
Al shrugged and said,
He's in a bar. I'd love to be with him.
At Abner's, the lunch crowd had finally arrived. The booths and tables were full, and the bar was packed with office workers washing down burgers with pints of beer. David had moved one stool to his right so that he was now next to Miss Spence. She was on her third and last Pearl Harbor. David was on his second. When she offered him his first, he had initially declined, claiming he had no taste for fussy mixed drinks. She insisted, and Abner whipped one up and slid it in front of David. Though it looked as harmless as cough syrup, the drink was a lethal combination of vodka, melon liqueur, and pineapple juice. They found common ground at Wrigley Field. Miss Spence's father had taken her there as a small girl, and she had followed her beloved Cubs her entire life. She had held season tickets for 62 years, a record, she was certain, and she had seen the great ones, Rogers Hornsby, Ernie Banks, Ron Santo, Billy Williams, Fergie Jenkins, and Ryan Sandberg. And she had suffered greatly, along with all Cubs fans. Her eyes danced as she told the well-known story of the curse of the Billy Goat. Her eyes moistened when she remembered, in detail, the great fall of 1969. She took a long sip after recounting the infamous June swoon of 1977. She let it slip that her late husband had once tried to buy the team, but was somehow outmaneuvered. After two Pearl Harbors, she was fairly smashed. The third was putting her away. She had no curiosity about David's situation. Rather, she preferred to do most of the talking, and David, who was in slow motion, was content to just sit and listen. Abner ventured by occasionally, making sure she was happy. At precisely 12:15, just as Abner's lunch business hit full stride, her Asian driver arrived to collect her. She drained her glass, said goodbye to Abner, made no effort to pay a tab, thanked David for the company, and left the bar, her left hand tucked inside her driver's elbow and her right hand working the cane. Her walk was slow but erect, proud. She'd be back.
Who was that? David asked Abner when he got close enough.
I'll tell you later. You having lunch?
Sure. Those burgers look good. Double cheese with fries.
You got it.
The cab driver's name was Bowie, and he was a talker. As they left the third funeral home, his curiosity could no longer be restrained.
Say, pal, I gotta ask, he chirped over his shoulder. What's with all these funeral homes?
Wally had covered the rear seat in obituary pages, city maps, and legal pads.
Let's head over to Wood and Ferguson on 103rd Street near Beverly Park, he said,
temporarily ignoring Bowie's question. They had been together for almost 2 hours, and the meter was approaching $180, a nice chunk in terms of cab fare, but chump change in the context of Crayox litigation. According to some of the news articles Lyle Marino had given him, the lawyers were speculating that a wrongful death case involving the drug could potentially be worth $2 to $4 million. The lawyers would take 40%, and Finley and Figg would, of course, have to share their fee with Zell and Potter or another tort firm spearheading the litigation. Still, after all the fee splitting, the drug was a gold mine. The urgent issue was finding the cases. As they rushed around Chicago, Wally was confident he was the only lawyer out of a million in the city who was, at that moment, shrewd enough to be combing the streets in search of Crayox victims. According to another article, the drug's dangers had just been discovered. And another one, quoting a trial lawyer, said that the medical community and the public in general were not yet aware of the Crayox fiasco. But Wally was now aware, and he didn't care how much he spent on cab fare.
I was asking about all these funeral homes, Bowie chirped again.
He was not going away, and he would not be ignored.
It's 1 o'clock, Wally announced. You had lunch?
Lunch. I've been with you for the past 2 hours. You seen me eat lunch?
I'm hungry. There's a Taco Bell up there on the right. Let's use the drive-thru.
You're paying, right?
Right.
I love Taco Bell.
Bowie ordered soft tacos for himself and a burrito supreme for his passenger. As they waited in line, Bowie said,
"So, I keep thinking, what's this guy doing at all these funeral homes, you know? None of my business, but I've been driving for 18 years and I've never had a ride who popped in on funeral homes all over town. Never had a ride who had that many friends, know what I mean?"
"You're right about one thing," Wally said, looking up from even more of Lyle's research. "It's none of your business."
"Wow, zing me on that one, didn't you? Pegged you for a nice guy."
"I'm a lawyer. From bad to worse."
"Just kidding. You know, my uncle's a lawyer.
Jerk." Wally handed him a $20 bill. Bowie took the sack of food and distributed it. Back on the street, he crammed a taco into his mouth and stopped talking.
Chapter 6 Rochelle was secretly reading a romance novel when she heard footsteps on the front porch. She deftly stuffed the paperback into a drawer and moved her fingertips to the keyboard so she seemed to be hard at work when the door opened. A man and a woman entered timidly, their eyes darting around almost in fear. This was not unusual. Rochelle had seen 1,000 come and go, and they almost always entered with grim and suspecting faces. And why not? They wouldn't be there if they were not in trouble, and for most it was their first visit to a law office.
"Good afternoon," she said professionally. "We're looking for a lawyer," the man said.
"Divorce lawyer," the woman corrected.
It was immediately obvious to Rochelle that she had been correcting him for some time, and he was probably fed up. They were in their 60s, though, a bit too old for divorce. Rochelle managed a smile and said, "Please have a seat." She pointed to 2 nearby chairs.
"I'll need to take down some basic information."
"Can we see a lawyer without an appointment?" the man asked.
"I think so," Rochelle said.
They backed into the chairs and sat down, then both managed to scoot the chairs farther away from each other. This could get ugly, Rochelle thought. She pulled out a questionnaire and found a pen.
"Your names, please. Full names."
"Calvin A. Flander," he said, beating her to the punch.
"Barbara Marie Scarborough Flander," she said. "Scarborough's the maiden name, and I might take it up again. Haven't decided yet, but everything else has been worked out, and we've even signed a property settlement agreement, one I found online, and it's all right here."
She was holding a large sealed envelope.
"She just asked for your name," Mr. Flander said.
"I got that."
"Can she take her old name back? I mean, you know, it's been 42 years since she used it, and I keep telling her no one will know who she is if she starts going by Scarborough again." "It's a hell of a lot better than Flander," Barbara shot back. "Flander sounds like some place in Europe or somebody who sleeps around. Flander or philanderer, don't you think so?"
Both were staring at Rochelle, who calmly asked,
"Any minor children under the age of 18?
Both shook their heads.
"Too grown," Mrs. Flander said. 6 grandkids.
"She didn't ask about grandkids," Mr. Flander said.
"Well, I damn sure told her, didn't I?"
Rochelle managed to guide them through birth dates, address, social security numbers, and employment histories without serious conflict.
"And you say you've been married for 42 years?"
Both nodded defiantly. She was tempted to ask why and what went wrong and couldn't this be salvaged, but she knew better than to start that conversation. Let the lawyers deal with it.
"You mentioned a property settlement. I assume what you have in mind is a no-fault divorce on the grounds of irreconcilable differences?"
"That's right," Mr. Flander said, "and the sooner the better."
"It's all right here," Mrs. Flander said, clutching the envelope. "House, cars, bank accounts, retirement accounts, credit cards, debts, even furniture and appliances?" Rochelle asked.
"Everything," he said.
"It's all right here," Mrs. Flander said again.
"And you're both satisfied with the agreement?"
"Oh, yes," he said. "We've done all the work. All we need is for a lawyer to draw up the papers and go to court with us. No hassle whatsoever."
"That's the only way to do it," Rochelle said, the voice of experience. "I'll get one of our lawyers to meet with you and go into more detail. Our firm charges $750 for a no-fault divorce, and we require half of that to be paid at the initial conference. The other half is due on the day you go to court."
The Flanders reacted differently. Her jaw dropped in disbelief as if Rochelle had demanded $10,000 in cash. His eyes narrowed and his forehead wrinkled as if this was exactly what he expected,
A first-class shaft job by a bunch of slimy lawyers. Not a word until Rochelle asked, "Is something wrong?"
Mr. Flander growled, "What is this? The old bait and switch? This firm advertises no-fault divorces for $399, then you get us in the door and double the price."
Rochelle's immediate reaction was to ask herself, what has Wally done now? He advertised so much in so many ways and in so many odd places that it was impossible to keep up with him. Mr. Flander stood abruptly, yanked something from his pocket, and tossed it on Rochelle's desk.
"Look at this," he said.
It was a bingo card from VFW Post 178, McKinley Park. Across the bottom was a bright yellow ad announcing, "Finley and Figg, attorneys, no-fault divorces, as easy as pie, $399. Call 773-718-JUSTICE. Rochelle had been surprised so many times that she should have been immune. But bingo cards? She had watched as prospective clients rifled through purses and bags and pockets to pull out church bulletins, football programs, Rotary Club raffles, coupons, and 100 other little pieces of propaganda that Attorney Figg littered around Greater Chicago in his ceaseless quest to drum up business. And now he'd done it again. She had to admit that she was indeed surprised. The firm's fee schedule was always a moving target, with the costs of representation subject to change on the fly, depending on the client and the situation. A nicely dressed couple driving a late model car might get a quote of $1,000 for a no-fault from one lawyer, and an hour later, a working stiff and his haggard wife could negotiate half that much from the other lawyer. Part of Rochelle's daily grind was ironing out fee disputes and discrepancies. Bingo cards, easy as pie for $399? Oscar would blow a gasket. "Okay," she said calmly, as if bingo card advertising were a long tradition at their firm. "I need to see your property settlement." Mrs. Flander handed it over. Rochelle scanned it quickly, then gave it back. "Let me see if Mr. Finley is in," she said. She took the bingo card with her. Oscar's door was closed, as always. The firm had a rigid closed-door policy that kept the lawyers shielded from each other and from the street traffic and riffraff that ventured in. From Rochelle's perch near the front, she could see every door. Oscar's, Wally's, the kitchen, the downstairs restroom, the copy room, and a small junk room used for storage. She also knew the lawyers had a tendency to listen quietly through their closed doors when she was grilling a prospective client. Wally had a side door he often used to escape from a client who promised trouble, but Oscar did not. She knew he was at his desk, and since Wally was hitting the funeral homes, she had no choice. She closed his door behind her and placed the bingo card in front of Mr. Finley. "You're not going to believe this," she said.
"What's he done now?" Oscar asked as he scanned the card. $399?
Yep.
I thought we agreed that $500 was the minimum for a no-fault.
No, we agreed on $750, then $600, then $1,000, then $500. Next week I'm sure we'll agree on something else.
I will not do a divorce for $400. I've been a lawyer for 32 years and I will not prostitute myself for such a meager fee. Do you hear me, Ms. Gibson? I've heard this before.
Let Figg do it. It's his case, his bingo card. I'm too busy.
Right, but Fig's not here and you're not really that busy. Where is he?
He's visiting the dead, one of his funeral laps around town.
What's his scheme this time?
Don't know yet. This morning it was taser guns.
Oscar laid the bingo card on his desk and stared at it. He shook his head, mumbled to himself, and asked, what kind of tormented mind could even conceive of the notion of advertising on bingo cards in a VFW?
Figg, she said without hesitation.
I might have to strangle him. I'll hold him down. Dump this riffraff on his desk. Make an appointment. They can come back later. It's an outrage that people think they can just walk in off the street and see a lawyer, even Figg, without an appointment. Give me a little dignity, okay?
Okay, you have dignity. Look, they have some assets and almost no debt. They're in their 60s, kids are gone. I say you split them up, keep her, start the meter.
By 3 p.m., Abner's was quiet again. Eddie had somehow disappeared with the lunch crowd, and David Zink was alone at the bar. Four middle-aged men were getting drunk in a booth as they made big plans for a bone-fishing trip to Mexico.
Abner was washing glasses in a small sink near the beer taps. He was talking about Miss Spence.
Her last husband was Angus Spence. Ring a bell?
David shook his head. At that moment, nothing rang a bell. The lights were on, but no one was home. Angus was the billionaire no one knew. Owned a bunch of potash deposits in Canada and Australia. Died 10 years ago. Left it with a bundle. She would be on the Forbes list, but they can't find all the assets. The old man was too smart. She lives in a penthouse on the lake, comes in every day at 11, has 3 Pearl Harbors for lunch, leaves at 12:15 when the crowd comes in, and I guess she goes home and sleeps it off. I think she's cute. She's 94. She didn't pay her tab. She doesn't get a tab. She sends me $1,000 every month. She wants that stool and 3 drinks in her privacy. I've never seen her talk to anyone before. You should consider yourself lucky. She wants my body. Well, you know where to find her.
David took a small sip of a Guinness stout. Rogan Rothberg was a distant memory. He wasn't so sure about Helen, and he really didn't care. He had decided to get wonderfully drunk and enjoy the moment. Tomorrow would be brutal, and he would deal with it then. Nothing, absolutely nothing, could interfere with this delightful slide into oblivion.
Abner slid a cup of coffee in front of him and said, "Just brewed it." David ignored it. He said,
"So, you work on retainer, huh? Just like a law firm? What could I get for $1,000 a month?"
"At the rate you're going, $1,000 won't touch it. Have you called your wife, David?" "Look, Abner, you're a bartender, not a marriage counselor. This is a big day for me, a day that will change my life forever. I'm in the middle of a major crack-up, meltdown, whatever it is. My life will never be the same, so let me enjoy this moment."
"I'll call you a cab whenever you want."
"I'm not going anywhere."
For initial client conferences, Oscar always put on his dark jacket and straightened his tie. It was important to set the tone, and a lawyer in a black suit meant power, knowledge, and authority. Oscar firmly believed the image also conveyed the message that he did not work cheap, though he usually did. He pored over the proposed property settlement, frowning as if it had been drafted by a couple of idiots. The Flanders were on the other side of his desk. They occasionally glanced around to take in the ego wall, a potpourri of framed photos showing Mr. Finley grinning and shaking hands with unknown celebrities, and framed certificates purporting to show that Mr. Finley was highly trained and skilled, and a few plaques that were clear proof he had been justly recognized over the years. The other walls were lined with shelves packed with thick, somber law books and treatises, more proof still that Mr. Finley knew his stuff.
"What's the value of the house?" he asked without taking his eyes off the agreement.
"Around 250," Mr. Flander replied.
"I think it's more," Mrs. Flander added. "This is not a good time to be selling a house," Oscar said wisely, though every homeowner in America knew the market was weak.
More silence as the wise man studied their work. He lowered the papers and peered over his drugstore reading glasses into the expectant eyes of Mrs. Flander.
"You're getting the washer and dryer, along with the microwave, treadmill, and flat-screen television?"
"Well, yes. In fact, you're probably getting 80% of the household furnishings, right?"
"I suppose. What's wrong with that?"
"Nothing, except he's getting most of the cash."
"I think it's fair," said Mr. Flander.
"I'm sure you do."
"Do you think it's fair?" she asked.
Oscar shrugged as if it weren't his business.
"Pretty typical, I'd say, but cash is more important than a trainload of used furniture."
"You'll probably move into an apartment, something much smaller, and you won't have enough room for all your old stuff. He, on the other hand, has money in the bank."
She shot a hard look at her soon-to-be ex-husband. Oscar hammered away.
"And your car is 3 years older, so you're getting the old car and the old furniture."
"It was his idea," she said.
"It was not. We agreed. You wanted the IRA account and the newer car. That's because it's always been my car. And that's because you've always had the nicer car."
"That's not true, Barbara. Don't start exaggerating like you always do, okay?"
Louder, Barbara responded,
"And don't you start lying in front of the lawyer, Cal. We agreed we would come here, tell the truth, and not fight in front of the lawyer, didn't we?"
"Oh, sure, but how can you sit there and say I've always had the nicer car? Have you forgotten the Toyota Camry?"
"Good God, Cal, that was 20 years ago."
"Still counts.
Well, yes, I remember it, and I remember the day you wrecked it.
Rochelle heard the voices and smiled to herself. She turned a page of her paperback.
AC, asleep beside her, suddenly rose to his feet and began a low growl. Rochelle looked at him, then slowly got up and walked to a window. She adjusted the blinds to give herself a view, then she heard it. The distant wail of a siren. As it grew louder, AC's growl also picked up the volume. Oscar was also at a window, casually looking at the intersection in the distance, hoping for a glimpse of the ambulance. It was a habit too hard to break, not that he really wanted to stop. He, along with Wally and now Rochelle and perhaps thousands of lawyers in the city, couldn't suppress a rush of adrenaline at the sound of an approaching ambulance, and the sight of one flying down the street always made him smile. The Flanders, though, were not smiling. They had gone silent, both glaring at him, each hating the other. When the siren faded away, Oscar returned to his chair and said, "Look, folks, if you're going to fight, I can't represent both of you." Both were tempted to bolt. Once on the street, they could go their separate ways and find more reputable lawyers, but for a second or two, they were not sure what to do. Then Mr. Flander blinked. He jumped to his feet and headed for the door. "Don't worry about it, Finley. I'll go find me a real lawyer." He opened the door, slammed it behind him, then stomped past Rochelle and the dog as they were settling into their places. He yanked open the front door, slammed it too, and happily left Finley and Fig forever. Chapter 7. Happy hour ran from 5 to 7, and Abner decided his new best friend should leave before it started. He called a cab, soaked a clean towel with cold water, then walked to the other side of the bar and gently punched him.
"David, wake up, pal. It's almost 5 o'clock.
David had been out for an hour. Abner, like all good bartenders, did not want his after-work crowd to see a drunk face down on the bar, comatose, snoring. Abner touched his face with the towel and said,
"Come on, big guy. Party's over."
David suddenly came around. His eyes and mouth flew open as he gawked at Abner.
What?
He stammered.
"It's almost 5 o'clock. Time to go home, David. There's a cab outside."
5 o'clock? David shouted, stunned at the news. There were half a dozen other drinkers in the bar, all watching with sympathy.
Tomorrow, it could be them.
David got to his feet and, with Abner's help, managed to pull on his overcoat and find his briefcase.
"How long have I been here?" he asked, looking around wildly as if he'd just discovered the place.
"A long time," Abner replied. He stuffed a business card into a coat pocket and said, "Call me tomorrow and we'll settle the tab." Arm in arm, they staggered to the front door and through it. The cab was at the curb. Abner opened the rear door, wrestled David into the seat, said, "He's all yours," to the driver, and closed the door. David watched him disappear into the bar. He looked at the driver and said, "What's your name?" The driver said something unintelligible, and David barked, "Can you speak English?"
"Where to, sir?"
the driver asked.
"Now, that's a really good question. You know any good bars around here?"
The driver shook his head.
"I'm not ready to go home because she's there, and, well, oh boy."
The inside of the cab had started to spin. There was a loud honk from behind. The driver eased into traffic.
"Not so fast," David said with his eyes closed.
They were going 10 miles an hour.
"Go north," David said. "I need a destination, sir,"
the driver said as he turned onto South Dearborn. Rush hour traffic was already heavy and slow.
"I might be sick," David said, swallowing hard and afraid to open his eyes. "Please, not in my car."
They stopped and started for 2 blocks. David managed to calm himself.
"A destination, sir," the driver repeated.
David opened his left eye and looked out the window. Next to the cab was a city transit bus waiting in traffic, packed with weary workers, its exhaust spewing fumes. Along its side was an ad, 3 feet by 1, proclaiming the services of Finley and Fig, attorneys.
"Drunk driving? Call the experts. 773-718-JUSTICE.
Address in smaller print. David opened his right eye and for an instant saw the smiling face of Wally Fig. He focused on the word drunk and wondered if they could help in some way. Had he seen such ads before? Had he heard of these guys? He wasn't sure. Nothing was clear. Nothing made sense. The cab was suddenly spinning again and faster now.
418 Preston Avenue, he said to the driver, then passed out.
Rochelle was never in a hurry to leave because she never wanted to go home. As tense as things could get around the office, they were far tamer than her cramped and chaotic apartment. The Flanders divorce got off to a rocky start, but with Oscar's skillful manipulation, it was now on track. Mrs. Flanders had hired the firm and paid a retainer of $750. It would eventually be worked out and settled on no-fault grounds, but not before Oscar clipped her for a couple of grand. Still, Oscar was fuming over the bingo card and lying in wait for his junior partner. Wally rolled in at 5:30 after an exhausting day looking for Crayox victims. The search had turned up no one but Chester Marino, but Wally was undaunted. He was onto something big. The clients were out there, and he would find them.
Oscar's on the phone, Rochelle said, and he's upset.
What's up? Wally asked.
A bingo card showed up, $399.
Pretty clever, huh? My uncle plays bingo at the VFW.
Brilliant.
She gave him the quick version of the Flanders situation.
See, it worked, Wally said proudly. You gotta get him in here, Miss Gibson. That's what I always say. The $399 is the bait, then you pull the switch. Oscar did it perfectly.
What about false advertising?
Most of what we do is false advertising. Ever hear of Crayox? Cholesterol drug?
Maybe.
Why?
It's killing people, okay? And it's gonna make us rich.
I think I've heard this before. He's off the phone.
Wally went straight to Oscar's door, rapped it as he pushed it open, and said,
"So, you like my bingo card ads, I hear."
Oscar was standing at his desk, tie undone, tired, and in need of a drink. 2 hours earlier, he'd been ready for a fight. Now he just wanted to leave.
"Come on, Wally. Bingo cards?"
"Yep, we're the first law firm in Chicago to use bingo cards. We've been the first several times and we're still broke."
"Those days are over, my friend," Wally said as he reached into his briefcase. "Ever hear of a cholesterol drug called Crayox?"
Yeah, my wife's taking it."
"Well, Oscar, it's killing people."
Oscar actually smiled, then caught himself.
"How do you know this?"
Wally dropped a stack of research onto Oscar's desk.
"Here's your homework, all about Crayox. A big mass tort firm in Fort Lauderdale sued Varick Labs last week over Crayox, a class action. They claim the drug vastly increases the risk of heart attack and stroke, and they have experts to prove it. Varick has put more crap on the market than any of the big pharmas, and it's also paid more in damages, billions. Looks like Crayox is its latest boondoggle. The mass tort boys are just now waking up. This is happening now, Oscar, and if we can pick up a dozen or so Crayox cases, then we're rich."
"I've heard this all before, Wally."
When the cab stopped, David was awake again, though semi-conscious. With some effort, he managed to toss two $20 bills over the front seat, and with even more effort, managed to extricate himself from the cab. He watched it drive away, then vomited in the gutter. Afterward, he felt much better. Rochelle was tidying up her desk and listening to the partner's bicker when she heard heavy footsteps on the porch. Something hit the door, then it swung open. The young man was wild-eyed, red-faced, unsteady on his feet, but well-dressed.
"Can I help you?" she said with great suspicion.
David looked at her but didn't see her. He looked around the room, wobbled, squinted as he tried to focus.
"Sir," she said. "I love this place," he said to her. "I really, really love this place. How nice. I'm looking for a job, and this is where I want to work."
AC smelled trouble and walked around the corner of Rochelle's desk.
"How cute," David said loudly, giggling. "A dog. What's his name?"
"AC."
"AC, all right, help me out here. What does AC stand for?"
"Ambulance chaser."
"I like it. I really, really like it. Does he bite?"
"Don't touch him." The two partners had moved quietly into view. They were standing in the door of Oscar's office. Rochelle gave them a nervous look.
"This is where I want to work," David repeated. "I need a job."
"Are you a lawyer?" Wally asked.
"Are you Fig or Finley?"
"I'm Fig, he's Finley. Are you a lawyer?"
"I think so. As of 8 o'clock this morning, I was employed by Rogan Rothberg, one of 600. But I quit, snapped, cracked up, went to a bar."
"It's been a long day."
David leaned against the wall to steady himself.
"What makes you think we're looking for an associate?" Oscar asked.
"Associate? I was thinking more in terms of coming straight in as a partner," David said, then doubled over in laughter. No one else cracked a smile. They were not sure what to do, but Wally would later confess he thought about calling the police. When the laughing stopped, David steadied himself again and repeated, "I love this place."
"Why are you leaving the big firm?" Wally asked.
"Oh, lots of reasons. Let's just say I hate the work, hate the people I work with, and hate the clients."
"You'll fit in here," Rochelle said.
"We're not hiring," Oscar said.
"Oh, come on.
I went to Harvard Law School. I'll work part-time, 50 hours a week, half of what I've been working. Get it? Part-time."
He laughed again, alone.
"Sorry, pal," Wally said dismissively. Not too far away, a driver hit the horn, a long, frantic sound that could only end badly. Another driver slammed his brakes violently. Another horn, more brakes, and for a long second, the firm of Finley and Fig held its collective breath. The crash that followed was thunderous, more impressive than most, and it was obvious that several cars had just mangled themselves at the intersection of Preston Beach and 38th. Oscar grabbed his overcoat. Rochelle grabbed her sweater. They followed Wally out the front door, leaving the drunk behind to take care of himself. Along Preston, other offices emptied as lawyers and their clerks and paralegals raced to inspect the mayhem and offer solace to the injured. The pileup involved at least four cars, all damaged and scattered. One was lying on its roof, tires still spinning. There were screams amid the panic and sirens in the distance. Wally ran to a badly crumpled Ford. The front passenger door had been torn off, and a teenage girl was trying to get out. She was dazed and covered in blood. He took her arm and led her away from the wreckage. Rochelle helped as they sat the girl on a nearby bus bench. Wally returned to the carnage in search of other clients. Oscar had already found an eyewitness, someone who could help place blame and thus attract clients. Finley and Fig knew how to work a wreck. The teenager's mother had been in the rear seat, and Wally helped her, too. He walked her to the bus bench and into the waiting arms of Rochelle. Vince Golston, their rival from across the street, appeared, and Wally saw him.
"Stay away, Golston," he barked. "These are our clients now."
"No way, Fig. They're not signed up."
"Stay away, asshole."
A crowd grew quickly as onlookers rushed to the scene. Traffic was not moving, and many drivers got out of their cars to take a look. Someone yelled, "I smell gas," which immediately increased the panic. A Toyota was upside down, and its occupants were trying desperately to get out. A large man with boots kicked at a window but could not break it. People were yelling, screaming. The sirens were getting closer. Wally was circling a Buick, whose driver appeared to be unconscious. Oscar was handing out business cards to everyone. In the midst of this mayhem, a young man's voice boomed through the air.
"Stay away from our clients," he yelled,
and everyone followed the voice. It was an amazing sight. David Zink was near the bus bench, holding a large, jagged piece of metal from the wreckage, waving it near the face of a frightened Vince Golston, who was backing away.
"These are our clients," David said angrily.
He looked crazed, and there was no doubt he would use the weapon if necessary. Oscar moved next to Wally and said,
"That kid may have some potential after all."
Wally was watching with great admiration. "Let's sign him up."
Chapter 8. When Helen Zink pulled into the driveway at 418 Preston, the first thing she noticed was not the well-worn exterior of Finley and Fig, attorneys at law. Rather, it was the flashing neon sign next door advertising massages. She turned off the lights in the engine and sat for a moment to gather her thoughts. Her husband was alive and safe. He just had a few drinks, according to one Wally Fig, a somewhat pleasant man who'd phoned an hour earlier. Mr. Fig was sitting with her husband, whatever that meant. The digital clock on the dash gave the time as 8:20, so for almost 12 hours now, she had been worrying frantically over his whereabouts and safety. Now that she knew he was alive, she was thinking of ways to kill him. She glanced around, taking in the neighborhood, disapproving of everything about it, then got out of her BMW and slowly headed for the door. She had asked Mr. Fig how exactly her husband made his way from the tall buildings of downtown Chicago to the blue-collar neighborhood around Preston Avenue. Mr. Fig had said he didn't have all the details, and it would be best if they talked about it later. She opened the front door. A cheap bell rattled. A dog growled at her but made no effort to attack. Rochelle Gibson and Oscar Finley were gone. Wally was sitting at the table clipping obituaries from old newspapers and dining on a bag of chips and a diet soda. He stood quickly, swiped his hands on his pants, and offered a big smile. "You must be Helen," he said. "I am," she said, almost flinching as he thrust out a hand to shake. "I'm Wally Fig," he said, already sizing her up. "A very nice package. Short auburn hair, hazel eyes behind chic designer frames. 5'8", slender, well-dressed." Wally approved. He then turned and waved an arm in the direction of the cluttered table. Beyond it, against the wall, was an old leather sofa, and on the sofa was David Zink, dead to the world, comatose again. His right pants leg was torn, a small wound from the car smash-up and its aftermath, but other than that, he looked quite undisturbed. Helen took a few steps over and gave him a look. "Are you sure he's alive?" she asked. "Oh, yes, very much so. He got into a scuffle at the car wreck and tore his pants." "A scuffle?" "Yep, guy named Golston, a slimeball across the street, was trying to steal one of our clients after the big wreck, and David here chased him off with a piece of metal. Somehow he tore his pants." Helen, who had endured enough for one day, shook her head. "Would you like something to drink? Coffee, water, scotch?" "I don't drink alcohol," she said. Wally looked at her, looked at David, looked back at her. "Must be a strange marriage," he thought. "Neither do I," he said proudly. "There's fresh coffee. I made a pot for David, and he drank 2 cups before taking his little nap."
"Yes, thank you," she said.
They sipped coffee at the table and spoke softly.
"The best I can tell," Wally said, "is that he snapped on the elevator this morning as he was going to work, cracked up, left the building, and wound up in a bar where he pretty much spent the whole day drinking."
"That's what I gather," she said. "But how did he get here?"
"Haven't got that far yet, but I gotta tell you, Helen, he says he's not going back. Says he wants to stay here and work."
She couldn't help herself as she glanced around the large, open, cluttered room. It would be difficult to imagine a place that appeared to be less prosperous.
"Your dog?" she asked. "That's AC, the firm dog. He lives here."
"How many lawyers are in your firm?"
"Just 2. It's a boutique firm. I'm the junior partner. Oscar Finley's the senior partner."
"And what kind of work would David do here?"
"We specialize in injury and death cases."
"Like all those guys who advertise on television?"
"We don't do TV," Wally said smugly. If she only knew.
He worked on his scripts all the time. He fought with Oscar about spending the money. He watched with envy as other injury lawyers flooded the airwaves with ads that, in his opinion, were almost always poorly done. And most painfully, he imagined all the lost fees from all the lost cases scooped up by less talented lawyers willing to roll the dice on a TV budget. David made a gurgling sound and followed it up with a quick nasal snort, and though he was at least making noises, there was no indication he was anywhere near consciousness.
"Do you think he'll remember any of this in the morning?" she asked as she frowned at her husband.
"Hard to say," Wally observed. His romance with alcohol was long and ugly, and he had spent many fogged-in mornings struggling to remember what had happened. Wally took a sip and said, "Look, really none of my business and all, but does he do this often? He says he wants to work here, and, well, we need to know if he might have a problem with the bottle."
"He doesn't drink much at all, never has. He might occasionally at a party, but he works too hard to drink much, and since I rarely touch the stuff, we don't keep it around the house.
Just curious. I've had my problems."
"I'm sorry."
"No, it's okay. I've been sober for 60 days now." That didn't impress Helen as much as it worried her. Wally was still fighting the bottle with victory far away. She was suddenly tired of the conversation and tired of the place.
"I suppose I should take him home."
"Yes, I suppose, or he could stay here with the dog. That's what he deserves, you know. He should wake up in the morning here on the sofa, still dressed, a splitting headache, upset stomach, parched tongue, and have no idea where he is. That would serve him right, don't you think?"
"It would, but I'd rather not clean up after him again."
"He's already..."
"Twice. Once on the porch, once in the restroom."
"I'm so sorry."
"It's okay. But he needs to go home."
"I know. Let's get him up."
Once awake, David chatted pleasantly with his wife as if nothing had happened. He walked unaided from the office, down the front steps, into the car. He yelled a long goodbye and a hearty thanks to Wally and even offered to drive. Helen declined. They left Preston and headed north. For 5 minutes, nothing was said. Then Helen casually began, "Look, I think I have most of the major plot points, but just a few details might help. Where was the bar?"
"Abner's, a few blocks from the office."
He was sitting low with the collar of his overcoat turned up over his ears. "Been there before?"
"No, great place, though. I'll take you there sometime."
"Sure, why not tomorrow? And you walked into Abner's at what time this morning?"
"Between 7:30 and 8 o'clock. I fled the office, ran a few blocks, found Abner's."
"And started drinking?"
"Oh, yes."
"Recall what you consumed?" "Well, let's see." He paused as he tried to remember. "For breakfast, I had 4 of Abner's special Bloody Marys. They're really good. Then I had a plate of onion rings and several pints of beer. Miss Spence showed up and I had 2 of her Pearl Harbors. Wouldn't want to do that again."
"Miss Spence?"
"Yeah, she shows up every day, same stool, same drink, same everything."
"And you liked her?"
"I adored her. Very cute. Hot."
"I see. She married?"
"No, widow. She's 94 and worth a few billion."
"Any other women?"
"Oh, no, just Miss Spence. She left sometime around noon and, let's see. I had a burger and fries for lunch, then back to the beer, and then at some point I took a nap."
"You blacked out?"
"Whatever."
A pause as she drove and he stared out the windshield.
"So how did you get from the bar to that law office back there?"
"A cab. Paid the guy $40.
"Where did you get into the cab?"
A pause.
"Don't remember that."
"Oh, now we're making progress. And the big question, how did you find Finley and Fig?"
David began shaking his head as he pondered this. Finally, he said, "I have no idea."
There was so much to talk about. The drinking? Could there be a problem in spite of what she'd told Wally? Rogan Rothberg? Was he going back? Should she bring up Roy Barton's ultimatum? Finley and Fig? Was he serious? Helen had a lot on her mind, plenty to say, a long list of complaints, but at the same time she couldn't help but be slightly amused. She had never seen her husband so plastered, and the fact that he'd jumped from a tall building downtown and landed in the outback would soon become a family tale of legendary proportions. He was safe, and that was really all that mattered, and he probably wasn't crazy. The crack-up could be dealt with.
"I have a question," he said, his eyelids getting heavier.
"I have lots of questions," she replied.
"I'm sure you do, but I don't want to talk now. Save it for tomorrow when I'm sober, okay? It's not fair to hammer me now when I'm drunk."
"Fair enough. What's your question?"
"Are your parents, by chance, in our home at this moment?"
"Yes, they've been there for some time. They're very concerned."
"How nice. Look, I'm not walking into our home if your parents are there. Got that? I don't want them to see me like this. Understand?"
"They love you, David. You scared all of us."
"Why is everyone so scared? I texted you twice and said I was okay. You knew I was alive. What's all the panic about?"
"Don't get me started."
"So I had a bad day. What's the big deal?"
"A bad day?
Actually, it was a pretty good day, come to think of it."
"Why don't we argue tomorrow, David? Isn't that what you asked?"
"Yes, but I'm not getting out of the car until they leave. Please."
They were on the Stevenson Expressway, and traffic was heavier. Nothing was said as they inched along. David struggled to stay awake. Helen finally picked up the cell phone and called her parents. Chapter 9. About once a month, Rochelle Gibson arrived for work expecting her usual quiet time, only to find the office already opened, the coffee brewed, the dog fed, and Mr. Fig bustling around with excitement over a new scheme to stalk injured people. This irritated her immensely. It not only ruined the few tranquil moments in her otherwise noisy day, but also meant more work. She was barely inside the door when Wally nailed her with a hearty, "Well, good morning, Ms. Gibson," as if he were surprised to see her arrive at work at 7:30 on a Thursday.
"Good morning, Mr. Fig," she replied with far less enthusiasm. She almost added, "And what brings you here so early?" but held her tongue. She would hear about his scheme soon enough.
With coffee, yogurt, and the newspaper, she settled at her desk and tried to ignore him.
"I met David's wife last night," Wally said from the table across the room. "Very cute and nice. Said he doesn't drink much, maybe blows it out from time to time. I think the pressure gets to him occasionally. I know that's my story. Always the pressure."
When Wally drank, he needed no excuse. He boosted up after a hard day, and he had wine with lunch on an easy day. He drank when he was stressed, and he drank on the golf course. Rochelle had seen and heard it all before. She also kept up with the score, 61 days without a drink. That was the story of Wally's life, a count of some sort always in progress. Days on the wagon, days until his driving suspension was over, days until his current divorce was final, and sadly, days until he was released from rehab.
"What time did she get him?" she asked without looking up from the newspaper.
"After 8. He walked out of here, even asked if he could drive. She said no."
"Was she upset?"
"She was pretty cool, relieved more than anything else. The big question is whether he'll remember anything. And if he does, the question is whether he'll find us again. Will he really walk away from the big firm and the big bucks? I got my doubts."
Rochelle had her doubts too, but she was trying to minimize the conversation.
Finley and Fig was not the place for a big firm type with a Harvard degree, and frankly, she didn't want another lawyer complicating her life. She had her hands full with these two.
"I could use him, though," Wally went on, and Rochelle knew the latest scheme was now on the way.
"You ever hear of a cholesterol drug called Crayox? You've already asked me this. It causes heart attacks and strokes, and the truth is just now coming out. The first wave of litigation is unfolding, could be tens of thousands of cases before it's over. The mass tort lawyers are all over it. I talked to a big firm in Fort Lauderdale yesterday. They've already filed a class action and are looking for more cases."
Rochelle turned to Paige as if she were hearing nothing.
"Anyway, I'm spending the next few days looking for Crayox cases, and I could sure use some help. Are you listening, Ms. Gibson?"
"Sure."
"How many names are in our client database, both active and retired?" She took a bite of yogurt and seemed exasperated.
"We have about 200 active files," she said.
At Finley and Fig, though, a file deemed active was not necessarily one that received attention. More often than not, it was simply a neglected file that no one had bothered to retire. Wally usually had about 30 files he would touch in a week's time. Divorces, wills, estates, injuries, drunk drivers, small contract disputes, and another 50 or so he diligently avoided. Oscar, who was more willing to take on a new client but was also slightly more organized than his junior partner, had about 100 open files. Throw in a few that were lost, hidden, or unaccounted for, and the number was always around 200.
"And retired?" he asked.
A sip of coffee, another grunt.
"Last time I checked, the computer showed 3,000 files retired since 1991. I don't know what's upstairs."
Upstairs was the final resting place for everything. Old law books, outdated computers and word processors, unused office supplies, and dozens of boxes of files. Oscar had retired before he added Wally as a partner.
3,000, Wally said with a satisfied grin, as if such a large number were clear evidence of a long and successful career.
"Here's the plan, Miss Gibson. I have drafted a letter that I want you to print on our stationery. It goes to every client, current and past, active and retired. Every name in our client database."
Rochelle thought of all the unhappy clients who had left Finley and Fig. The unpaid fees, the nasty letters, the threats of malpractice lawsuits. She even kept a file labeled Threats. Over the years, half a dozen or so disgruntled ex-clients had been angry enough to put their feelings on paper. A couple promised ambushes and beatings. One mentioned a sniper's rifle. Why not leave these poor people alone? They had suffered enough having passed through the office the first time. Wally jumped to his feet and walked over with the letter. She had no choice but to take it and read it.
"Dear Blank, beware of Crayox. This cholesterol drug made by Varick Labs has been proven to cause heart attacks and strokes. Though it has been on the market for 6 years, scientific evidence is just now revealing the deadly side effects of this drug. If you are using Crayox, stop immediately. The law firm of Finley and Fig is at the forefront of Crayox litigation. We will soon be joining a national class action lawsuit in a highly complicated move to bring Varick to justice. We need your involvement.
If you or anyone you know has a history with Crayox, you may have a case. More important, if you know of anyone who has taken Crayox and has suffered a heart attack or stroke, please call immediately. A lawyer from Finley and Fig will be at your home within hours. Don't hesitate. Call now. We anticipate a huge settlement. Sincerely, Wallace T. Fig, attorney and counselor at law.
Has Oscar seen this? She asked.
Not yet. Pretty good, huh?
This for real?
Oh, it's so real, Miss Gibson. This is our biggest moment.
Another gold mine?
Bigger than a gold mine.
And you want to send 3,000 letters?
Yep, you print them, I'll sign them, we'll stuff them, and they go out in today's mail.
That's over $1,000 in postage.
Ms. Gibson, the average Crayox case will generate something like $200,000 in attorney's fees, and that's on the low side. Could be as high as $400,000 per case. If we can find 10 cases, the math gets real easy. Rochelle did the math, and her reluctance began to fade. Her mind began to drift. With all the bar journals and newsletters that crossed her desk, she had seen 1,000 stories about big verdicts and big settlements, lawyers making millions in fees. Surely they would give her a fine bonus.
All right, she said, shoving her newspaper aside.
Oscar and Wally had their second Crayox fight not long afterward. When Oscar arrived at 9 a.m., he could not help but notice the flurry of activity around the front desk. Rochelle was working the computer. The printer was in high gear. Wally was signing his name to letters. Even AC was awake and watching.
What's all this? Oscar demanded.
The sounds of capitalism at work, Wally answered cheerfully.
What the hell does that mean?
Protecting the rights of the injured, serving our clients, purging the market of dangerous products, bringing corporate wrongdoers to justice.
Chasing ambulances, Rochelle said.
Oscar looked disgusted and continued to his office, where he slammed the door. Before he could remove his coat and park his umbrella, Wally was at his desk, nibbling on a muffin and waving one of the letters.
You gotta read this, Oscar, he said. This is brilliant.
Oscar read it, the wrinkles in his forehead getting deeper and deeper with each paragraph. When he finished, he said, Come on, Wally. Not again. How many of these are you sending out?
3,000, our entire client list.
What?
Think of the postage. Think of the wasted time.
Here we go again.
You'll spend the next month running around chirping about Crayox this and Crayox that, and you'll waste 100 hours looking for worthless cases and on and on. We've been here before, Wally. Come on. Do something productive.
Like what?
Like go hang out in an emergency room somewhere. Wait for a real case to come in.
I don't have to tell you how to find good cases.
I'm tired of that crap, Oscar. I want to make some money. Let's hit it big for a change.
My wife's been taking the drug for 2 years. Loves it.
Did you tell her to stop, that it's killing people?
Of course not. As their voices grew louder, Rochelle eased over and quietly closed the door to Oscar's office.